From Breezewood to Ridgeway, Smithport to Somerset, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, an FBI investigation and charges of fiscal mismanagement hover over the Pennsylvania School Employees Retirement System, or PSERS. Hunter Tower from Freedom Foundation is here with details. 2020, of course, was a difficult year for Pennsylvania's gaming industry, but there were some financial bright spots. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi have all the numbers on this week's Allegheny Institute report. And it is budget time in Harrisburg. The state is flush with a revenue surplus and billions in federal recovery dollars. What to do with all that money? Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has a Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Hunter Tower of the Freedom Foundation in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. State Senator Judy Ward of Blair County and Representative Jeff Wieland of Lycoming County say they will introduce legislation to amend the Pennsylvania Constitution to strengthen voter ID requirements. Currently, voters only have to provide ID the first time they vote at a precinct. The lawmakers want to require the showing of personal identification each time a voter casts a ballot. According to the Center Square, Ward and Wieland see the move as strengthening ballot security that has become a major issue in the wake of last November's disputed presidential election. In a rare bipartisan vote, the Pennsylvania Senate this past week approved a bill requiring the General Assembly to give its approval before the governor can enter the state into multi-state compacts. At issue is the proposed Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGI. REGI is essentially an energy tax that would significantly increase consumer electric bills under the guise of cutting carbon emissions, which proponents claim are contributing to climate change. Governor Tom Wolf is working to enter Pennsylvania into the REGI compact without legislative approval. The Senate vote is the first step toward giving lawmakers a say in the process. The annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, the largest gathering of conservative activists in the state each year, was held last week, and a straw poll of attendees was conducted. With open seats for both U.S. Senator and Governor, most of the candidates were in attendance at the event. In the straw poll, State Senator Doug Mastriano won the most votes for governor, with former Congressman Lou Barletta coming in second. Sean Parnell had the most tallies for U.S. Senator, followed by Jeff Bartos. A complete report on the straw poll can be found at politicspa.com. And read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania's Public School Employees Retirement System, commonly known as PSERS, is under FBI investigation, and its governing board is embroiled in a fight over investment policies. To learn the details, we turn to Hunter Tower. Hunter is Pennsylvania State Director of Freedom Foundation. Hunter, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Hunter, with most of the attention focused on bringing the COVID-19 pandemic restrictions to an end, the problems at PSERS have been relegated to the back pages, but the problems here are very serious, so much so there are even bipartisan efforts underway to address them. So please fill us in on the current situation.
The PSERS, so for those who are unfamiliar with it, it's the Pennsylvania Public School Employees Retirement System. And this pension fund is one of the nation's largest in our entire country. It sends more than $6 billion in pension checks each year to over 265,000 retired teachers and other former school employees. And it's actually been unveiled that the Pennsylvania Teachers Retirement Fund is under FBI investigation due to initially being about kickbacks and bribery concerning real estate investments. And actually now, they've invested funds in the oil fields in northern Iraq owned by the Kurds, and it's just a colossal failure of what's been going on. And actually, it just came out in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review that among the 9 board members who refrained from signing this demand letter from PSERS leadership to be fired, it was actually board chairman Christopher Santamaria, who is actually a teacher and a former union leader in the Lower Merion schools, and several other board members who are actually tied to PSEA, which is the state's biggest teachers unions. And they've staunchly defended this the PSERS manager, regardless of this whole debacle.
In addition to that, there are some issues regarding the amount of contributions that teachers were required to put into the system each year that were miscalculated?
Absolutely. There was supposed to be a certain percentage of growth over a 9-year period ending in, I believe, June of this year, was higher than meeting the threshold, but they actually fell pretty short of that. And because to make up for these completely erroneous calculations and this complete debacle mess of what they've done, is actually they've now figured that the school employees will have to increase their contributions by 0.5% of their salary, while some will even have to pay up to 0.75% of their salary just to make up for these missed mistakes. And it's just amazing. It just goes to show, on top of, obviously, we're very union-driven, public sector union-driven organization to free workers from forced unionization, but it's just amazing that they're already nickeling and diming the current teachers on payroll to make up for those mistakes, while at the same time deducting union dues, usually typically 1.5% to 2.5% of their wages. And it's pretty much this cycle of corruption we've seen. So they deduct these dues, and most of these dues fund the campaigns and politicians who agree to do their bidding once safely in office. And then once elected, you know, these politicians pass legislation to raise taxes on private sector businesses and individuals in order to keep growing the size of government. And as government continues to grow and more employees are hired, unions can take more union dues from, obviously, the union members themselves. And it just keeps cycling and cycling. And obviously, we see that with the board members who have a vested interest in keeping kind of the status quo. And it's just a complete mess and just corruption to its core.
Who then are holding the management accountable for these errors and for this corruption if the board isn't doing it?
Thankfully, we've seen in the news, I mean, State Representative Frank Ryan has been a pretty staunch advocate for this, to holding their feet to the fire. And now we've even seen our state treasurer, Stacey Garrity, actually working alongside, actually last week, Katie Muth, who's a Democrat state senator from Montgomery County. They've actually sued the Peacers, trying to get to the bottom of this. And they've been actually joined by former treasurer, who's on the board as well, as Joe Torsella. So when you have Republicans and Democrats getting along on this issue, something is definitely going wrong.
Yes, getting Republicans and Democrats together in Harrisburg is next to impossible. They seem, however, to be united in a desire to actually get information. You've mentioned that all of these individuals are on the board, yet they're not being given the financial information and other items that they want from management at Peacer. So how is it that they now have to go into court in order to get documentation and they're actually board members? What chance does anybody else have?
I completely understand. And I mean, it just goes to show the power of the unions and what they have. I mean, they don't want to share anything. We see this on our end as well, from grassroots effort when we trying to get union members to opt out as well. I mean, this is from the very bottom level. And I mean, we get shut out from right to know requests from the governor's office and things like that. I mean, it just goes to show how much power these government unions, especially these teachers unions, have over board members of one of the nation's largest pension fund. I mean, it's just like, where does the buck stop? It's just amazing.
So we have the FBI doing investigations. We have board members demanding more transparency and more information. Any idea where this goes to from here?
Well, hopefully the court settles it out for everyone, and we're hopeful for that positive outcome, especially for the teachers who are going to have to pay for this at the end of the day. I mean, and again, this hurts the taxpayers, because these teachers who are going to have their contributions up into this retirement program, the taxpayers are paying their salary and in turn paying the rest of this, and we're funding this. So, I mean, that just means taxes are going to go up. And then, obviously, I'm sure we're going to hear from the governor and some other leading heads on this that are bought and paid for by the public unions, that they need to have another government entity, or they need to have more government, and it just means more taxes and killing businesses. I mean, especially after the past 15, 16 months of this lockdown mess and this pandemic stuff we've unfortunately have to been dealing with here in the Commonwealth, I think we need a break.
We are talking with Hunter Tower, who is the Pennsylvania director of Freedom Foundation. And speaking of union power, our schools, our public schools, have been either virtual or partially virtual for most, if not all, of the past school year. Now it comes to light that the guidance from the Wolf administration has actually been coming from some of the state's largest and most powerful teacher unions. Can you give us some background on that?
There's a bombshell report that happened a few weeks back that from the publication Broad and Liberty that disclosed that found Tom Wolf's chief of staff and his deputy chief of staff met with the heads of the American Federation for Teachers, Pennsylvania's chapter here, and the head of the PSEA, Pennsylvania State Education Association. So what happened after that, obviously a lot of schools and local school boards were kind of waiting on guidance of where to go from there. And when they met obviously it came out that we're going to keep schools shut down, we're going to keep kids virtual or masked up or whatever it may be. And it was directly after that meeting. And it's kind of ironic because it's, you know, you have pretty much a similar case that happened with, you know, Randy Weingartner with AFT, that when they met with the Biden administration, the CDC, right after that, the national guidance from the NEA and all these other teachers unions, they've said the same thing. So it just trickled down to the state and local level. And it's just, it's such a shame because it's hurting our kids. It's hurting our families. And honestly, we've even heard from our state point, we've heard from teachers that want to go back into school. They miss, you know, the high five, and they miss seeing their kids. And I mean, it's such a shame of we're not really going to see the repercussions of all this mess that the teachers unions have caused.
Taking a look now at the fact that, as you mentioned, teachers are being really forced in many ways to pay dues to these labor unions. There, of course, was a ruling a number of years ago, a couple of years ago now, that they weren't required to do that. Have we seen teachers leaving unions, and are the teacher unions still throwing roadblocks in the way of those who want to actually leave to resign their membership in these unions?
Oh, absolutely. 3 years ago, we're actually coming up on the, we call it Janiversary. It's the anniversary of Janus versus AFSCME, which is the American Federation for State, County, Municipal Employees. And it happened on actually June 27th, which was confirmed by the Supreme Court in 2018. And this was a guy, Mark Janus, who was from Illinois, was kind of getting ticked off that his dues were getting deducted, and he saw his dues going to, you know, Democrat politicians and other causes and lobbying efforts for very left-wing things, and he didn't like that. He wanted to do something about it, so made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they ruled in his favor, and they affirmed his First Amendment right that no public sector employee, if they want to refuse their membership, have to be compelled to pay union dues. So we've seen this since the three-year anniversary of this. We actually opened up Pennsylvania operations here just last year in March, about a week or two before the shutdowns. And we've actually seen over almost $1.5 million that we've removed from these government unions because we show workers, you know, you do have your right to opt out. And we're seeing it now, like I said previously, we're coming up on the third anniversary of this, and workers still don't know their rights. And a lot of time, it's so sad from our standpoint. I mean, we're happy to do it. It's what we do for a living, that we come to their doorstep, or they receive our mailer, or we give them a phone call, and they're first hearing about their rights from us and not their employer or their union. And that just raises alarms everywhere.
Hunter Tower of the Freedom Foundation. Hunter, tell us a little bit more about the Freedom Foundation. Also, where can folks go on the website if they would like to learn more about your organization?
We're a national 501c3 nonprofit. Our mission is to advance individual liberty, free enterprise, and limited accountable government. And we're also nationally known for freeing workers from forced unionizations because it's obviously their right via the Supreme Court in 2018. And they can go to www.freedomfoundation.com to learn more about us.
Hunter Tower, Pennsylvania Director of Freedom Foundation. Hunter, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you, Loman. I really appreciate the time.
Pennsylvania's gaming industry has expanded significantly in recent years. And despite some setbacks due to the COVID-19 pandemic, gambling opportunities have continued to expand. Frank Gamrat and Eric Montardi run through the numbers on this Allegheny Institute report.
Hello and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is the Executive Director of the Allegheny Institute, Frank Gamrat. Frank, one of the recent briefs that you wrote and is available at our website at www.alleghenyinstitute.org is on what looks like could be a rebounding in the gaming industry. You've written about gaming for a long time as the industry has grown in Pennsylvania, the new forms of gaming that have been added, and 2020 was quite a year. Now you have a complete set of data for that year. Can you give our listeners an idea of what things looked like for last year and where they might be headed this year?
What makes gaming so noteworthy and why we follow it is that, of course, in 2004, it was sold to us as a way of lowering property taxes from our school districts. So slot machines were legalized. 34% of gross terminal revenues from slot machines were to go into a fund for property tax reduction. And at one point in time, we used to get rebates. Now we just get notices from our school district saying, hey, thank you, and move on. So you don't really even notice it that much. But over the years, they added new forms of gaming, tables, and that tax money goes to the general fund. And then in 2019, they introduced a couple of others, four new others, as a matter of fact, internet gaming, which is both tables and slots, sports, fantasy gaming, which is where you select a group of players and each week you compete with other players and and how they do on their statistics, and then sports wagering directly, and then something called video gaming terminals, which are small video gaming terminals set up at truck stops. And so you have the two traditional and the four new ones.
What happened in terms of the number of casinos last year during the pandemic? Mm-hmm. Now in 2021, you started to use a measurement of a per machine revenue, and that's kind of an interesting number you could share with our listeners. That'd be great.
Right. Untangling the slots. We looked at just from 2015 through 2019's numbers. On an average year, it would be like $2.3 billion just in gross terminal revenues from slots for those 4 years. In 2020, it came in at $1.355 billion, so about $1 billion less than what it had been from 2015 through 2019. That's a pretty good drop. So the question we then ask is, what about 2021? How have things progressed? Now, in January and February, it was still kind of small, still low. The gap between what an average January was from 2015 to 2019 was about $180.7 million. And in January 2021, it was only $140.7 million, so about $40 million below that four-year average. And of course, it has dramatically closed as the months went on. People were vaccinated, started going back in. Most recent data we have is April, and that four-year gap was just down to $4 million. It was $205.4 million from April 2015 to April 2019. In April 2021, it was only $201.39 million. So the gap has shrunk. In 2015, you had 26,300 slot machines over 12 casinos on a monthly basis, you know, 26,300. By 2019, that dropped to 24,700. Now, part of that was table games tended to be a more lucrative thing for casinos, so they were substituting table games in for slot machines. So that was just a natural decline in the business model. You had 12 casinos opening from 2015 through 2019. In late 2020, a 13th casino was opened in Westmoreland County. And in 2020, a 14th casino, they're called mini casinos, was open in Philadelphia. And so there are a couple more casinos designed to come online. These are called mini casinos that the state lowers auctioning these licenses off. And they had a real hard time giving those guys away. So I think there's two more in the works, but I'm not quite sure. You look at the amount of money played per machine. And it was kind of low. It was about $7,500 from that in 2015. It had gone up to like $7,900 in 2019. It was fairly level, fairly flat. Well, it fell a little bit, $7,200 in 2020, but it jumped tremendously in 2021. The average is $8,860 per machine. And what was really interesting is both March and April, our two recent months, had over $10,000 per machine in gross terminal revenue, and that's the highest it's ever been. You're looking at more intensive play as the pandemic starts to wane, vaccinations picked up. While that's good news for the Commonwealth, probably bad news for the gamblers.
Let's move away from the ones where, you know, you have to go into a casino to play them.
iGaming was obviously became big in 2020. It debuted in 2019, it only had like $33 million for the couple of months that it was open in 2019. In 2020, internet gaming, which is internet tables, internet slots, hit $565.8 million in 2020. And that was for the full year. Now, of course, people were stuck at home, had nothing better to do. Let's go online. Let's start gambling. If you look at thus far in 2021, they've already brought in 4 months, $346.6 million. If that continues to play out, you're looking at $1 billion in internet gaming, which would surpass the total for table games, which is only like $800 to $900 million. Questions surrounding internet gaming is, what's going to happen going forward? Do people want to stay in their homes and gamble? Or are they looking to get back into the casino? So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Now, the next largest category is sports wagering, which you had mentioned. In its first full year of 2019, only $84 million. In 2020, that doubled. Little more than doubled to $189 million, and that was despite most sports leagues having modified schedules. It didn't have an NCAA tournament, which is a huge gambling weekend, week, month, whatever it is, and that was gone. You missed a good portion of baseball and college football and NFL football. Thus far in 2021, through 4 months, $106 million has already been gained on sports wagering. That's the revenue from all the companies. If you extrapolate that out to a full year, you're looking at $318 million in 2021. We're projecting about $4.3 billion if all holds. Now, that, of course, assumes that people continue to do what they're doing. It could be a little bit less if they decide to go back to the casinos and don't do the internet gaming so much. That'll be a record for the state, for the Commonwealth. So it really will be a big deal. Now, the question going forward is the pandemic was certainly an interesting case. What happens when there's a real downturn, a recession, and the money that was pumped in by the federal government is no longer there, and we have a decent recession? What will happen? You know, the state and the local municipalities get hosting fees. They've gotten awfully used to that money, and I think they've gotten maybe too comfortable with it. And what happens when you have a serious downturn? And then let's not even forget the social ills that are caused by gaming, compulsive gambling and whatnot that no one's really ever actually looked at, and that data is not even available for us to look at.
Frank, great stuff as always, and we always tell our listeners, if you want to read this brief and others, you can visit our website, which again is www.AlleghenyInstitute.org. For Frank Gamrat, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal.
Lawmakers in Harrisburg have a rare revenue surplus and billions in Federal Recovery Act dollars. They're now trying to figure out what to do with all of that money. Ashley Klingensmith from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania has a few suggestions on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
We are now over halfway through the month of June, which means the state budget is being crafted, debated, and will soon be passed. This year's spending plan has the boost of $7.3 billion in federal economic stimulus, and in addition, legislators and appropriators have revenue which has exceeded expectations by over $1 billion. Speaker Cutler recently told the Center Square, "We are better than $2 billion in surplus." The conversation happening is now one around how to spend the surplus. While the Democrats have put together a spending plan for the federal dollars, Republicans have not. They've been having the conversation of where to spend and on what to spend, including how much should be placed into a reserve or bolster our rainy day fund. Last year, we sent a letter to the chairman of the House and Senate Appropriations Committees, encouraging them to find all waste and unnecessary spending. We included a list of nearly $730 million which could be eliminated. We've also regularly called on lawmakers to pass budgets that provide a pathway for long-term economic growth by embracing lower spending, less regulation, no tax hikes, and increased transparency. The new 2021 reality of a surplus all but guarantees that decisive action on spending cuts will be tough to realize. But while the process in Harrisburg marches on with a certain nod to the status quo, legislators in Washington have put together a proposal that is rooted in principle. Recently, the House Republican Study Committee released its federal budget resolution, and while it will never receive a vote in Congress, it provides an excellent framework around features Congress and state houses should strive for in any proposal. First, it balances the federal budget in 5 years. The annual federal budget deficit in 2020 was $3.1 trillion, and the deficit in the first 7 months of fiscal year 2021 was another $1.9 trillion. These deficits are being recorded even as federal tax revenues are at an all-time high. So the Republican Study Council proposal restrains spending to allow the budget to balance in 5 years. Second, it reduces spending. The RSC resolution calls for $14.4 trillion less in spending over the next 10 years than is currently expected, for a total of $47.76 trillion during that time span. And this would be anything but a draconian cut, as the annual average is nearly $4.8 trillion, which is more than the U.S. government ever had spent in a single year until the pandemic hit in 2020. Spending would climb to $5.4 trillion by 2031. By contrast, the Biden budget would increase spending by a reported $5 trillion over the next decade. And third, the plan reduces the tax burden. This proposal includes tax reductions totaling $1.9 trillion over the next 10 years, from an estimated total of approximately $49 trillion. It does so through tax changes that would encourage savings, investment, and economic growth. Those include the repeal of the inheritance tax and of special tax breaks, as well as full expensing for research and development and other investments. The plan by the Republican Study Committee includes restraint of spending and taxes, a return to fiscal solvency, and an attempt to begin to solve long-term budget challenges. Any budget resolution put forward for serious debate in D.C. should seek to accomplish at least that much. But both Washington and Harrisburg have one significant thing in common. They rely on us, the taxpayer, to fund their budgets. And these respective capitals produce nothing, simply appropriate what we produce and generate. It is paramount that we hold members in our federal delegation, as well as those in Harrisburg, accountable. Budgets have become so complex and voluminous that it can be tough for members to know what's in them, let alone for us to know what's in them. However, we're going to continue to report on the good, the bad, and the ugly, and always encourage you to join us in grassroots lobbying efforts. This week, we implore you to visit AmericansForProsperity.iVolunteers.com. My name is Ashley Klingensmith. I'm State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania. To find us on Facebook, search at PAAFP, and on Twitter by searching at AFP Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 26 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WXTU-FM in Bella Cynwyd, along with WBVP-AM and WMBA-AM in Beaver Falls, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations. They include the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania. We'll be right back.
Thank you.